To the third and final lecture in the Core Issues in Jewish Theology series given by Rabbi Shai Held. Tonight's talk is on walking in God's ways and the path of loving kindness, chesed. If you've missed any of the previous lectures or you want to relive some of your favorite memories, you can go to the Machon Hadar website, which has all of the videos. My name is Rachel Druck, and I'm a full-time fellow at Yeshivat Hadar, and I've had the privilege of studying with Rav Shai throughout the year. And I find it to be incredibly satisfying that this series is ending with a discussion about chesed, because Rav Shai has really been the model of how, you know, you can talk about Borer all you want, but in the end, a life of Torah is really all about love and the ways in which we can manifest that love in the world to make it a better place. So without further ado.
Okay. All three introducers have kept to my script, which I'm grateful for. Okay, so tonight I have, you know, the third and final task of this series, and in many ways the most difficult one, which is to begin to talk about what I think a life of faith ultimately looks like. And I'd like to do that by first focusing on a couple of aspects of the life of faith that I think are often overlooked in presenting what a religious life looks like, and then really focus specifically on what I will argue is the culmination of a life of faith from the perspective of the Jewish tradition, which is a life of loving kindness, of chesed. So to begin, I just want to clarify one crucial point. Faith may also be a subjective state, but it can't ever be only a subjective state, right? That is, it is a subjective state manifest as a set of outward behaviors, or maybe even better, manifest as a way of doing and being in the world. What it means to have faith is to translate that, what we called last week, existential posture or life orientation, into a particular mode of being in the world. Now, if you had asked many of the teachers that I had as a young person, what does the life of faith consist of? How is faith manifest in the world? They likely would have answered, the life of faith consists in the observance of Torah and mitzvot. The observance of Torah and God's commandments. And as far as that goes, for a faith to be authentically Jewish, it begins there. The mistake, the tragedy, is when sometimes we're tempted to think that it ends there rather than begins there. By the way, there may be many forms of faith that do not begin with a life of Torah and mitzvot, but I would argue that even if we understand those categories expansively, a notion of Jewish faith has to begin there. Now, the irony is that I'm going to suggest that even and sometimes especially people who seem deeply pious and religious get this fundamentally wrong and think that faith is exhausted by a commitment to observance. In other words, right, my argument, and I'll suggest in a minute that it's the Rambam's argument, is that Torah and mitzvot are not ends in themselves, or maybe to be a little more conservative with a small c, not only ends in themselves, but also and primarily represent a path of connection to God, other people, and ultimately myself as well. The danger, in other words, is that the path replaces rather than points to the destination. Right? The danger is that the path itself becomes confused for the destination. That was an obsessive preoccupation of Maimonides. Now, in his, as we've discussed at some length, in his perspective, the path that mitzvot represented is the path towards intellectual perfection. We might want to complicate that and talk about moral virtue, emotional connection with God. We might want to put all kinds of categories there as an end, but we would surely agree with the Rambam, I hope, at least if I convince you, we will, right? That ultimately, they are pointers and guides not only ends in themselves. The Rambam, this is most famously manifest when the Rambam writes his epistle on the resurrection of the dead. He begins with a kind of somewhat ferocious outburst in which he writes, and you can imagine this was not a way to win friends at the rabbinical convention, right? He writes, "My biggest concern is that lots and lots, that is, most of the rabbis of my time, are basically pagans who observe the commandments." Right? That is, they have an incredibly simplistic understanding of God and what they're worshiping. They're pagans who are shomrei mitzvot. And the Rambam basically thinks that's as good as worthless. Now again, we might want to be more generous. We might want to be more charitable. We might not agree with how we categorize what the end is. But the notion that Torah and mitzvot, while not negotiable, are a path rather than the destination, I think is an important one to keep in mind. And I'll have a little more to say about this in a little while. So, I'm going to begin tonight by suggesting four aspects of the life of faith as I think it ideally is manifest in the world. And here I'm speaking both textually and personally about, to be perfectly honest, my own aspirations, even as I fail to live up to them all the time. The first is what I will call, borrowing from two verses, one in Psalms and one in Proverbs, Tehillim and Mishlei, the B'chol Drachecha Da'ehu model of the spiritual life. That is, in all your paths, in all your ways, know God. If you look for a second on the packet that I gave you, part one, the first verse is an extremely well-known verse, and it's usually interpreted to apply in ritual, liturgical context, but I want to suggest it's a more all-encompassing principle, and that is, Shiviti Adonai L'negdi Tamid, right? I have set God before me at every conceivable time and place. And then the verse in Proverbs, B'chol Drachecha Da'eyu V'hu Yasher Orchotecha, right? In all your ways, know God. And just to sort of buttress the point that what I'm about to say is textually rooted, look for a second at the third passage, which is a famous statement in the Babylonian Talmud, in the Bavli. Darash Bar Kapara, Bar Kapara said, Ezehu parashak tonash, tanash, kol gufei Torah tuliyim ba, what is a small thing on which everything in the Torah hangs? That was a little bit of a loose translation, but it's fair enough. And the answer is, B'chol drachecha de'eyu v'hu yasher ochotecha. In other words, all of the mitzvot, on some level, Bar Kapara says, are rooted in or captured in this verse, know God in all your ways. And then comes a line which I'm sad to say we do not have the time to talk about tonight, but is incredibly interesting and generates an extraordinary amount of controversy in the history of Jewish legal writing. Amar Rava, Rava says, Afilu lidvar aveira, even if you are about to sin. And this is one of the places where the commentators on the Talmud consider the possibility that sometimes sinning in the name of God is a more holy act than observing the law. Maimonides seems to flirt in the fifth of the eight chapters, his introduction to ethics, with the notion that there are moments when the cultivation of virtue means an obligation to stray outside the lines of the law. If you read certain contemporary English translations, they immediately say in huge, you know, you can feel the all caps, this does not apply in any way in our time, right? Which is a kind of anxiety that's derived from a correct reading of what Rava is saying. Okay, now, so what does it mean? So we know these verses, and we've seen this contention here in the Talmud that kol gufei Torah, all of the essential foundations of the Torah, depend on it. But what is it? So I'd like to suggest the following formulation, which is that the claim here is that mitzvot are suggestive rather than exhaustive. Okay? Now, I just want to be clear. I do not mean in any way to suggest that mitzvot are mere suggestions. Right? I mean that they are instantiations of a broader relationship but that no concrete list of instantiations can ever exhaust the fullness of a relationship. Just as I can't capture in a piece of paper all the things that I obligate myself to do for and with my wife in marrying her, so also in being in a covenantal relationship with God, I can't exhaust that list by saying, okay, I just did number 613, kicking my feet up. See you in a few weeks when we start again, right? In other words, they are moments, concrete moments, but again, they're not the whole story and they can't ever be. Any relationship in which someone says to you, right, here's a concrete list, and this is all I owe you in the context of our togetherness, right, is someone you should be cautious about being involved with. Now, but even more fundamentally, if we take seriously the famous formulation of the Zohar, which is Leit Atar Panui Mine, there is no place in the world devoid of God's presence, that means that we can find and serve God wherever we find ourselves. So the temptation to say, I'd love to be in relationship with God, but I don't have time to go to shul today. Or I'd love to serve God, but I don't have time to open a holy book today, is actually what this verse and this Talmudic passage, I suggest, are trying to overcome. In other words, the basic claim of faith is, be where you are and find and serve God exactly there. Now, I want to suggest a couple of modern formulations of this. There's a really kind of amazing Hasidic story about a Hasidic master named Rabbi Moshe of Kobrin. And the story is that a student comes to his Beit Midrash, to his study hall, and asks one of Rabbi Moshe's students, what is the most important thing in the world to the Rebbe? Expecting as an answer some kind of theological principle or some kind of concrete practice. And the student says, what is the most important thing in the world to the Rebbe? Whatever he's doing at that moment. That story is the encapsulation of B'chol drachecha da'ehu, in all your ways, know him. Now, if you look at the fourth passage, this is, I would suggest, the culmination in the evolution of this phrase of what a model of B'chol drachecha da'ehu as a spiritual path looks like. This is from Rav Kook's Ethics. Rav Kook, the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Palestine, he says, I'll read this in English. In all your ways know him. One must seek the Blessed Holy One in the midst of the ways one acts. When one is engaged in prayer, one should seek the Blessed Holy One in understanding the substance of one prayer and in the appropriate focused intention, kavanah ritzuya, on the substance of one's prayer. During the time that one is praying, one should not seek to know God through other matters, because since one is engaged in this service, God is, as it were, present at one's side in this worship specifically. And there alone, one will find God, and not in some other place. Similarly, Rav Kook goes on, when one is engaged in Torah, one should know that one will find the Blessed Holy One when delving in and trying to understand a matter thoroughly. And through that, one will know the Blessed Holy One in God's Torah and not in any other matter, because at that time, God is revealed in that act of service and worship. And also, he says, when one is engaged in acts of loving kindness to benefit one's fellow, then one should seek the Blessed Holy One only through deeper thought on the way to benefit one's friend with great sustainable aid. By the way, this, among many other things, is also, I think, a repudiation of at least a few lines in the Guide of the Perplexed, where Maimonides talks about how, okay, you can do earthly things as long as you're really thinking about God all the time. And I think Rav Kook is actually saying, yeah, you should be thinking about God all the time, but not by being absent, but by being more deeply present. That's the claim, right? To think about God actually entails being more present where one is. So Rav Kook goes on, also in all the things one does. By the way, what he's just done is Torah avodah milul chasadim, right? The study of Torah, worship, and chesed. But you think that that's enough? Rav Kook says, no, it's true in everything you do. The truth is that there is nothing in the world that is not for the honor of the Blessed Holy One. Hence, everything one does will be according to God's commandment and will. And in each action, one should search for God. Now, I'll stop there, and I'll just tell you, What he goes on here says is kind of it's a beautiful linguistic thing. He says, what does bichol drachecha de'ehu mean? Really underline the bet. Bi, meaning really inside. Inside of everything you do, you should know God. In other words, not spend your time thinking about, oh, I have to finish this task so that then I can do the stuff that I'm really alive for. Right? The ultimate, maybe moderns are more prone to this than others, right? If I just can, like, respond to these 97 emails, then I can do what I was born and put in this world to do, right? Which is respond to more emails. No, I mean, but seriously, right? To really be present on the inside. This, in other words, is mindfulness of the presence of God, right? As a project. Mindfulness of the presence of God and mindfulness of the fact that no space is devoid of God. Now, Heschel has an interesting sentence in which he writes, religion is not what man does with his solitariness. Religion is what man does with the presence of God. Now, I would just suggest that that formulation is crucially right and crucially wrong, right? Because for the religious person, for the person who's living a life of faith, life, and not just religion, is what man does with the presence of God. Right? Life, in other words, is about overcoming the distinction between calling certain things religious and calling other things secular, but actually finding melo chol ha'aretz kvodo, the whole world is filled with God's presence. So that's first. Mindfulness of the presence of God. The second, and this could be an elaborate discussion which we don't have time for, is the emphasis on free will not as a theological doctrine, but as a spiritual practice. Maimonides, as many of you know, insists that the whole project of Torah, the whole project of relationship with God, makes no sense absent the assumption of meaningful human freedom. But I want to suggest that this is totally missed when we think of it as an abstraction. Right? Human freedom, as we'll see Rabbi Soloveitchik say in a minute, human freedom is about another kind of consciousness cultivation, which is that at every moment that I feel compelled to do X, I have the capacity for a breath and a decision. That's the basic claim of taking free will seriously is, I'm not an automaton. That's why the culmination of the spiritual life for many Jewish thinkers is tshuva. Because what tshuva is ultimately the process of reinvigorating my capacity for freedom. So if I'm tempted to say, I am the kind of person who always does X in situation Y, one has to revise that statement to be, until this moment, I have always been the type of person who does X in situation Y. But in this moment, I am free. That, by the way, is also one of the ways in which meditation and psychotherapy and lots of other seemingly non-explicitly liturgical Jewish practices have the capacity to become mitzvot, right? Because if they actually liberate us for the capacity to act freely, then they are restoring to us the dignity with which God creates us. So between stimulus and response, there is always the possibility of a decision. Now, if you look for a second at this paragraph from Rabbi Soloveitchik from one of his sermons on repentance, this is on page 2 of the packet, the assumption that man is free, that he has been endowed with the spiritual courage to make choices and with the power to determine the fate of his religious and moral life, this assumption cannot rely on the idea of belief by itself. It also depends on knowledge, on a feeling of being wholly charged by the tension present in this God-given factor of free choice. Skipping one sentence, this is the meaning of Maimonides to know, a continuous awareness of maximal responsibility by man without even a moment's inattentiveness. So this is actually another dimension of mindfulness in the presence of God. Not just mindfulness of the presence of God, but mindfulness of my own freedom in the presence of God. Now, third, and here I want to suggest, although this may surprise some people, that I would claim this is actually the hardest manifestation of faith, I think, for a lot of us. And that is, I think that if you are alive in the world and you take faith seriously, there is an unavoidable tension and conflict. Don't begin to describe what I'm groping for, but we'll start by saying tension and conflict. On the one hand, the Torah tells us that one of the most basic Jewish claims about the world is that every human being is created in the image of God and is therefore infinitely valuable. Right? Every human being is created in the image of God and is infinitely valuable. On the other hand, all I have to do is be awake in the world for a matter of seconds to discover that human dignity is trodden and trampled upon in countless ways, every second of the day, in every conceivable place, in every time. Hunger, disease, oppression, degradation, abuse, you name it. So on the one hand, we start with this claim, every last individual as an individual, not just as an example of some species called humanity, but as an individual, matters ultimately in the eyes of God, and yet our lives make a mockery of that claim. And I want to suggest that one of the most important things that faith does is, first of all, not lie to itself by either saying, oh, you know what, I'll give up on that Pollyanna fantasy that everyone matters, or B, you know what, I'll live in my upper middle class bubble and not notice, by the way, nice try, right? Because moments of human degradation take place in plain old conversations, not just in dramatic scenes, right? So to actually be awake to this tension is point number one. And the other is to commit that as a constant object of awareness, the life I lead, if I say that I am in relationship with God, is about affirming the dignity of each and every human being I come into contact with, no matter to what extent history testifies otherwise. Anything short of that is not a life of faith. And actually, in my opinion, forgive me for speaking more personally than the last 2 weeks, is obscene and blasphemous. Right? To talk about faith and not be committed to the project of human dignity is to be religiously out to lunch. That's a technical term. Now, fourth and finally, before we move to loving kindness, I want to suggest that a crucial dimension of a mature faith is the capacity to hold complexity. Actually, let me say it that way. The capacity to hold complexity, or to hold at the same time dialectical truths. What Rabbi Soloveitchik wonderfully called dialectics without synthesis. There's claim A, there's claim B, and then there's life. But there's no claim C that makes it all better. So I'll give you three extremely brief examples of these. These are mine, not his. One, the students in the yeshiva have heard me say this a few times, but I think it's really important. One is that Judaism says at one and the same time that every human being is infinitely valuable, and also that each of us is totally insignificant and nothing. And the point is, no Jewish thinker has ever succumbed to the temptation to say, okay, so therefore human beings are somewhat valuable. Right? No, right? The point is, these two truths are held simultaneously. And a mature life of faith is actually saying, I can hold these poles together in my mind and my experience at the very same moment. The second, and in a way this is derivative of what I just said about Tzelem Elohim, about the image of God, is the capacity to stare at wondrous beauty and horrific suffering in the very same life at the very same time. And again, not to lie to oneself. The lie is, the world is wondrous. Therefore, there is no pain. Or to say, the world is excruciating. Therefore, there is nothing wonderful here at all. But actually to say, as the Midrash imagines Avraham saying, the experience of God is born in an awakeness to both poles of human experience, and more importantly, to both poles of reality itself. And then, finally, a third example, and this is maybe the hardest for some, is the capacity to experience joy and grief at the very same time. These are actually all versions of each other, but the capacity to experience joy and grief at the very same time, I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. To me, one of the most exquisite liturgical moments of the Jewish year, which may have originated as a coincidence, but it is actually totally exquisite, is that on Shabbat Chol HaMoed Sukkot, right, during the Sukkot festival, we do two things within 10 minutes of each other. We first recite the Hallel, in which we say, "This is the day which God has made. It is wondrous in our eyes." And we read the book of Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, and say, "Nothing means anything. It's all emptiness." And I want to suggest that that moment is the moment when we are asked, almost more than any other liturgical moment in the Jewish year, to grow up and have faith. Real faith. Real faith not as a simple list of things to believe in or a catalog of already digested truths, but real faith as the capacity that is to be awake to the complexity of the world in which we have been placed. To live dialectic without kidding ourselves about our capacity for synthesis, right? To put this crudely, the resolution to joy and grief is not permanent equanimity. It's actually joy and grief. Okay. So now, the fifth dimension of faith that I want to talk about is really the final one, and that I want to kind of spend some time elaborating. And I'll begin by describing something that happens at the end of Maimonides' Guide to the Perplexed. And my footnote to this, for those who are oriented in scholarly ways, is to know that there have been as many interpretations of the very last few paragraphs of the Guide to the Perplexed as there have been people who have read it. If you decide to spend your life as a Maimonides scholar, you too can write an article about the meaning of Book 3, Chapter 54 of Maimonides' Guide to the Perplexed, and you too will be disagreed with. But what I want to suggest, what I'm interested in about this chapter is, I think, unequivocally a part of what Maimonides is doing, and that's all we need. Maimonides spends the last chapter of the Guide to the Perplexed, Book 3, Chapter 54, in good medieval fashion, listing four types of human perfection and grading them from the least important perfection to the ultimate perfection. Those four levels of perfection, going into great depth about them, are, first of all, we might find this odd to think of this as a perfection, but perfection of property and belongings, that is, having everything I need. By the way, perfection of property and belongings for Maimonides and most of the medievals does not mean being rich, right? It means having what I need. The second level of perfection is physical bodily perfection, being healthy. The third level of perfection, and here some might struggle with Maimonides' prioritization. The third level of perfection is moral virtue. And the fourth and ultimate level of perfection is intellectual perfection, cognition of God, which, if you were paying attention the first week, you realize is a weirdly paradoxical claim for Maimonides, because people have to then spend their time what it means to say that the highest capacity of the human being is to know just how profoundly I don't know. This really interesting paradox at the heart of Maimonides' sense of human completion. But okay, so he makes the choice that moral perfection is antecedent to intellectual perfection. Intellectual perfection is the highest level that a human being can arrive at. But then, it's almost as if, to use crude terms, the Jew trumps the Aristotelian philosopher. And Maimonides, as an attempt to prove his description of the four perfections, quotes from Jeremiah. And if you look at part 3, the first verses, Jeremiah chapter 9, verses 22 and 23, although in my very limited unscientific example, most people who are even very well Jewishly educated in our time don't know this verse, But almost all medieval rabbis who were interested in philosophical questions were extremely preoccupied with these two verses. So the verse says as follows. I'll read it in English just for time's sake. Thus says the Lord, let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, let not the strong man glory in his strength, let not the rich man glory in his riches. Now, we won't spend time trying to figure out how Maimonides somewhat insistently and somewhat stretchingly insists that the three perfections he listed as the lower level map on to these three things that Jeremiah says I should not be proud of. But, perfection number four, only in this should one glory, says Jeremiah, understanding and knowing me. Haskel v'yadoa oti. And the point that Maimonides himself points to is, this is where, on some level, as a philosopher who's just been taking me, Maimonides, seriously, I want the verse to end. But Jeremiah doesn't end it that way. Jeremiah says, understanding and knowing me, for I, the Lord, act with kindness, justice, and equity in the world, for in these I delight, declares the Lord. In other words, Maimonides does this amazing move, which is, when you really achieve intellectual perfection, what do you discover? That God is the God of chesed, mishpat, utzdakah. And to truly know God is to aspire to embody the things that we attribute to God. So intellectual perfection culminates in a mode of interpersonal behavior. Now, many scholars sort of fight about this. Is Maimonides actually articulating here a fifth level of perfection, which is sort of moral perfection number two? That is, that I am morally perfect in a different way after knowing God than if I don't. But at very least, what he's saying is that there is no intellectual perfection in the sense of knowing God if it doesn't necessarily spill over into a new way of being in the world. To know God is to seek to embody the attributes of God. And we're going to talk about that, give flesh to that a little bit more in a minute. And obviously Maimonides makes a dramatic choice in choosing really to end the guide with these verses, right? They are the ultimate, you could say, self-subverting verses, right? Yes, it's intellectual perfection. And what is one of the most fundamental constitutive pieces of intellectual perfection? The life of chesed. Now, so you already have Jeremiah and Maimonides essentially making this claim. And if you look at the next text, you see that the rabbis do the very same thing. Whether or not they have this verse in mind, I don't know. But this passage, Sifrei Dvarim, Dorshei Agadot Omrim, the expounders of Agadah say, Ritzoncha lahakir et mishamar v'haya olam, is it your desire to know the one who spoke and the world came into being? And lahakir, by the way, is not, this is in contrast to medieval, is not a term of cognition, but a term of intimacy, right? Do you want to know the one who brought the world into being, they ask. So what should you do? Limod Haggadah, study Haggadah, Shemitochach atamakir et misha amar vaya olam. Because through studying theology or Agadic narratives, that is to studying the stories, the narratives that the Jewish people tell about the world, you will come to know, in the sense of intimacy, the one who spoke the world into being. But of course, the Midrash doesn't end there, but rather says, Shemitoch kach, ata makir et mi sha'amar havaya ha'olam, umidabek bidrachav, and cleave to his ways. Now, this is amazing, because they never asked if you were interested in cleaving to God's ways. All they asked is whether you want to be intimate with God. And the answer was, if you want to be intimate with God, you should learn this aspect of Torah. Or, I'll just say this, you know, in shorthand, you should do theology. But if you do that, you can't help but ineluctably be drawn to a life of chesed. If you actually study, this, by the way, is a great litmus test for us in thinking about what it means to study Torah. You can spend 57,000 years in yeshiva and be described by everyone on the planet as the Gadol Hador, right, as the greatest thinker of all time. And if you're not driven by that learning into chesed, you have actually not begun to learn Torah. You know, there's a great story about this that I'm remembering now. It's a cute line, but student goes to the Kutzker Rebbe and says, Rebbe, I've been through the Bavli 15 times. And the Kutzker says to him, really? And how many times has the Bavli been through you? And I think this is a very important claim. This is like a really important claim about, it actually is, I mean, an aspiration for how we study, but also in some sense, a test for how we study. Meaning, if you spend your life studying Torah and are not manifestly kinder, there's a fundamental brokenness in the whole enterprise. So now, in light of this, in light of the fact that even Maimonides, who prioritizes the intellectual, and even those rabbinic passages that seem to celebrate learning, push us to culminate that learning in a way of being and acting in the world, I want to take a step back and think together about how the life of chesed is connected to and rooted in the life of faith. So I'll start by saying that covenant in Jewish theology has two dimensions to it, always as far as I can tell. Covenant is both a concrete contract with a set of obligations, and B, a set of infinite aspirations. You might even want to say a set of asymptotic aspirations, things that I can come closer to, but I will never fully embody. So, for example, if I get married, I have both, and I'm bracketing all of the crucially important questions about gender that emerge from this conversation for the moment. I have, on the one hand, a contract, a ketubah, that is actually nothing more than a contract. And actually, when people often look at a Jewish ketubah and say, where's the romance in this document, they're asking the wrong question and the right question, meaning it's not supposed to be there. Ketubah is actually a list of concrete obligations. But you'd be insane, right, and humanly deficient if you thought, okay, there's three things I owe. I've done them, you know, time to watch, what do they call that when they replay the Yankee games on the Yes Network late at night? Time to watch, nobody knows in this whole room, time to watch the Yankees on whatever, sponsored by W.B. Mason. I can't remember what it's called. Okay. On the contrary, what we do is move on in the wedding ceremony to read the Sheva Brachot, which basically tell the story of the cosmos from its creation to its final redemption. Now, if all we do is read those words and not think about what we're saying or doing, then we have fallen into the temptation of seeing the mitzvot as this kind of weird destination rather than a path. Because the claim we make at a wedding is that this moment, right? This moment is a crucial moment in the unfolding of the history of the cosmos. When I list the points of human history or cosmic history that matter in the journey towards redemption, this moment between these two people is one of those moments. That's an enormous blessing and a really profound challenge. And the moment you take that seriously, you can't ever for another minute think that a contract can ever exhaust your obligations to another person. Right? Because love is not listable in a legal document. So similarly, if you take Judaism's divine-human covenant, the covenant between God and Israel, one of Judaism's divine-human covenants, the covenant between God and Israel, there is again a concrete contract that is, I'm suggesting, Taryag Mitzvot. That is a concrete list of things one has to do. 613 commandments. The Shulchan Aruch, code of Jewish law. But if you think for one second, right, that, oh God, I'm done, I'm now going to watch baseball, right, then you've totally not even entered the conversation. Because the culmination, the infinite aspiration of the covenant is to manifest my love for God as compassion and kindness in the world, as a life of chesed. And I'll show you this in text in a minute. So we have, again, the model of a contract that is, in theory, listable, and then a set of aspirations that is, of course, not listable, because after all, it's infinite. I mean, imagine my writing a list of every conceivable situation in which I could possibly find myself in my relationship with another human being. First of all, that's not possible. That's why the B'chol Drachecha Da'ehu stuff we talked about at the beginning is so important. But also, to enter into a covenant is not just to sign up for a list of things to do, but to articulate an aspiration for something I want to be. And the something I want to be, according to the Jewish tradition, is a Baal Chesed, a person who does Chesed in the world. Now, so follow with me, if you would, the bottom of this page, bottom of page 2. 5 times in the book of Deuteronomy, the Jewish people are told that they have a mandate of v'halachta bidrachav, and you should walk in God's ways. And one of the striking, I think, interesting pieces of Sefer Dvarim is that it never tells us what that means, what that consists of. And you might imagine, and you'd be on good ground to imagine this, that if the text of the Bible were not clear about what it means, this would be an opportunity for endless ambiguity and conversation among the rabbis about what it refers to. I mean, even when the text seems to be totally clear, it's an opportunity for endless conversation about what it means. But when the text is totally unclear, all the more so, it should be an opportunity for incredible, complex range of views. But amazingly, this is one of the only things about which you can say that the rabbis of the canonical period, Chazal, our sages, are univocal. They have one understanding of what walking in God's ways means, and that is the life of Chesed. It's an amazing claim, right? They all agree about this as far as we can tell. Now, so if you look for a second first at the book of Deuteronomy, I'm going to suggest something that I think is important. Okay, so now we'll start with the Hebrew. Va'atai Yisrael, and now Israel. Ma Hashem Elohecha Sho'el Mi'imach. What does the Lord your God ask of you? And then two of my favorite words in Tanakh. Ki'im li'ir'ah et Hashem Elohecha. Lelechet b'chol drachav u'la'avauto u'la'avod et Hashem Elohecha b'chol v'avcha v'chol nafshecha. What does God ask of you? Only this. Right? Only this. Right? To hold the Lord your God in awe, to walk in God's ways, to love God, and to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and soul, etc. That's one of the great onlys in the history of human civilization, right? Only this, right? Now, that is to say, only everything. Now, if you look at this verse closely, you will notice something that when I first began to notice, it really actually shifted my understanding of the project of Torah, and that is that the verbs in this verse have a fascinating alternation of emotion, action, right? So li'ir'ah is an, it's not only an emotion in Biblical Hebrew, but it's also an emotion. La'lechet, an action. La'ahava, an emotion. And la'avod, to serve, an action. In other words, I think the Torah here is signaling those who care to read that Judaism's aspiration is for an integration of the inner and the outer. An integration of our inner life, what we feel, and our outer life, how we behave and what we do. Now, I won't belabor this point, but, you know, one of the great caricatures of Judaism that the history of Christian anti-Semitism perpetrated on Jews, but it perpetrated it to the extent that Jews internalized it, right, and actually now oftentimes claim it as an item of pride, is when we say things like, I myself once taught Hebrew school and inflicted this very horrific caricature, right? Christianity cares about love, but Judaism cares about what you do. Or better yet, Christianity cares about love, but Judaism cares about justice. Or, in its more dramatic formulation, Judaism doesn't care about what you feel. Judaism is only interested in what you do. Now, so the only thing that's wrong with this is that it mischaracterizes Judaism and Christianity, right? Besides for that, it's extremely rich and insightful, right? Meaning, first of all, that no Christian thinks that, oh, you know, you should have this subjective state, and who cares what you do, Even Kierkegaard, despite his critics, doesn't think that. But nor does any sane Jew think, oh, here's a list of things to do, and what goes on inside you, I could give a damn. Right? By the way, I've had teachers in yeshiva say things like that, which is nuts. In other words, here's where that mistake gains a little bit of ground, but where it's actually totally misleading. If you said to the rabbis of the Talmud, if I have a choice between feeling care for someone and doing nothing for them, or feeling nothing for them and doing something for them, in every case, Chazal would say, feel nothing and do something. But let me give you the mirror case. If I walked up to the rabbis of the Talmud and said, if I have a choice between bad and worse, which do you prefer? And they said, I prefer bad. And then I built a whole theology in which I said, Judaism is all about bad. Right? That would be insane. Actually, right, the claim of the rabbis is very clear. If you have these two pretty unappealing alternatives, then ultimately a commitment to self-transcendence means do something for the other person rather than entertaining yourself with your own subjective states. But what do you want to aspire to? A life where the inner and the outer totally coalesce, right? Where the inner and the outer become one. Now, I would actually suggest that the word chesed is an amazing word for this. Usually when you say to someone, what does the word chesed mean in English? They will say loving kindness, and the word will cause their eyes to glaze over and think about old Yom Kippur Machzorim, right? Thee and thine glory bestowest upon us thy loving kindness. And by the way, this is very prevalent. One contemporary translator of Abraham Joshua Heschel, who is a teacher of mine and a very smart, thoughtful, soulful person, says the word loving kindness is unredeemable. Doesn't mean anything. So my suggestion is very simple. If you want to understand what the life of Chesed is about, reinsert the space between the two parts of loving kindness, and you actually have a claim about what the spiritual path culminates in. Love manifested as kindness. An internal state manifested as a set of concrete actions in the world. Chesed is love manifested as kindness. That's what loving kindness is. Now, again, you can do acts of chesed before you're there, but let's not confuse the reality of our human limitations with the aspiration of Torah. Now, I'm running out of time, so I'm not going to focus our attention so much on the next two the next two passages, which are the top of page 3, are two of the most well-known passages in all of rabbinic literature, and we could spend a lot of time on them, and we will not. I will just point out that the earlier passage, the first one quoted, is a list of virtues. Being merciful, being gracious, etc. And the second, the comment in the Babylonian Talmud, is a list of concrete actions, burying the dead, visiting the sick, comforting the mourners, etc. It's as if the Bavli is nervous, the Babylonian Talmud is nervous, that I might mistakenly think of virtues as a list of inner states, as opposed to dispositions that manifest in how I behave in the world, and so it comes with a concrete list. And what I would draw your attention to, which I think is actually very important, is that the list of actions in this Babylonian Talmud passage are all about showing kindness to those who are in situations of vulnerability. And the claim is, you may be tempted to turn away precisely here. Okay, I'll be nice to my chavruta in yeshiva, but an old lady who's sick, that's way too scary, that's my mortality. Or taking care of someone who's died, oh, that's even more crazy for me, I totally can't do that. Or visiting someone my age who's sick, I can't do that. And here, the rabbis are saying, you know, chesed is a possibility in every human relationship, but ultimately we are pushed to love in the places where fear tells us we ought not to. That's the argument, I think, of this Gemara, of this piece of Talmud, that precisely the places where we don't want to be are the places where we're asked to love. Now, I'll say one last thing about this notion of walking in God's ways. V'halachta bidrachav. I had been studying Maimonides for a lot of years before I finally got what he was doing in this one passage that's reproduced on your sheet, but we won't read together. I'll just talk about it for a minute. I think he would never utter these words, but Maimonides was tortured by a question that many people might share, and that is, wait a second, what if I don't believe in the kind of God who is actively visiting the sick, comforting the mourners, burying the dead? And you don't have to spend a lot of time with the God of the Perplexed or even the beginning of the Mishneh Torah to realize that Maimonides doesn't believe in that kind of God in any way that is, let's say, in any way that is obvious, but I'm saying that to protect Maimonides. But Maimonides does something kind of amazing, which is that he says, okay, so there's two meanings of the word chesed. One is, I owe you something, but I choose to give you more. I owe you two, but I give you four. Another is, I owe you nothing, but I choose to give you something. Two models of chesed. Maimonides says, when the prophets ascribe the word chesed to God, they almost always mean a situation in which I owe you nothing, but I choose to give you something. And then comes what I think in many ways is the punchline of the whole Guide of the Perplexed, which is missed by almost all readers, where he says, right, that's why we say in Tanakh that the world is built on chesed. Olam chesed yibaneh. Because the very fact that there is a world is an act of absolute grace. That is, God owes me nothing and gives me something. Or, to put this in my language, none of us ever did anything or ever could do anything to earn the gift that is life. Or, to put it yet another way, my life and the world are both gifts. Or, to put yet another way, my life is a gift within a gift. My life is a gift within a gift. My life is a chesed within a chesed. It is an act of grace within an act of grace. God could not conceivably owe me anything, and yet there is a world, and yet there is my life. And I think what the Rambam, what Maimonides is saying in his characteristically subtle way is, you know what? I don't need a God who's visiting people in the hospital. I don't need a God who's like, you know, burying Moses on some mountain. All I need is to believe in creation, and the mandate for my life is set. I am the recipient of grace, therefore I aspire to be a bestower of grace. I have been the recipient of kindness, therefore I aspire to be a bestower of kindness. All I need to believe, says the Rambam, is Briat HaOlam, the creation of the world. That is, someone is responsible for this world. If I believe that, I have the mandate for the whole project that is the spiritual life. To serve God by imitating the attribute, this is not a great formulation for Maimonides, but the attribute that goes into the creation of the world, which is grace. Okay. Since I want to stop, I'll just tell you for a second what is on the backside of this packet. Exodus 23:9 and Leviticus 19:33-34 are two of the places in which we are told that because of our experience in Egypt, we are commanded to love the stranger. And there's a lot to talk about that. Actually, I'm sorry. In Exodus, we're commanded not to oppress the stranger. In Leviticus, we are commanded to actively love the stranger. And a couple of maybe less than obvious points. For many of us, much of the time, and for all of us some of the time, the ways we've suffered make us think, to hell with the world, I don't know anybody anything. I was a slave in the land of Egypt, therefore, screw you. That is a piece of every human psychology, no matter how big or small your Egypt. In truth, right, our hearts are usually simultaneously enlarged and shrunk by experiences of suffering and estrangement. And the Torah is here asking us to choose to cultivate the enlargement, right? To cultivate the enlargement of the heart in the face of the possibility of the shrinking of the heart. It is also saying something, I think, enormously powerful, which is that when you read Leviticus 19, 18, I believe it is, 17 or 18, V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, 18, right? Leviticus 19, 18, you should love your neighbor as yourself, like every other inquisitive student, you want to quote the Gospel of Luke and say, who is my neighbor? And so a few psukim later, a few verses later, the book of Leviticus says, the stranger is your neighbor. The person who has no land, the person who is politically vulnerable is your neighbor. You think your neighbor is just your social circle? You think your neighbor is the people who live inside your building on the Upper West Side as opposed to under it? You are lying to yourself. The stranger is your neighbor. V'ahavta lo kamocha. You should love him too. So the Torah is actually asking us both to expand our hearts and to expand the circle of our concern. And by the way, if I had a lot of time, I'd also point out that it makes a stunning choice here, which is to talk both about love and to use the word ezrach, which is a political category for citizenship, which is to say that the stranger can never be allowed to be vulnerable to the question of whether I happen to feel compassion at a particular moment. That is, that the dignity of the stranger has to be protected by the political realities of a society and not merely by what Elaine Scarry calls the generous imaginings of the powerful. Oh, I happen to like what this homeless person looks like, but not that one. So this one's going to do fine, and that one's going to do badly. Actually, ka'ezrach mikem yeh is about a political claim. It's not just about compassion, but it's also the reality of this person. Now, two final points about this, each of which could be much longer, but I'll say them as quickly as I can. I want to suggest that when Exodus 23:9 says, "V'ger lo tilchatz," you should not oppress the stranger. "V'atem yedatem et nefesh hager," for you know the heart of the stranger. That is not only in the indicative mode, but it is also in the imperative mode. That is, that the Torah is saying that the only way to know that you will not oppress the stranger is to know your own estrangement. And if we know anything about human life, right, it is that a lack of awareness of my own estrangement, pain, suffering, humiliation is the best way possible to never love the stranger. So how do I not oppress the stranger? By the art of knowing, coming to know my own estrangement. So again, the work of the inner and the outer are totally interwoven. To understand my inner experience in a way that deepens my capacity for outer experience. Now, one final point about these verses, and I think this is sort of a really powerful and difficult challenge. If you take the mandate of walking in God's ways and loving the stranger seriously, you find something amazing. Walking in God's ways is about responding to the kindness that has been done to you by cultivating compassion. Loving the stranger is about responding to the cruelty that has been done to you by cultivating compassion. So there's two ways in life to develop a sense of entitlement, right? These are my two versions of entitlement. Number one, I had everything in life as a kid. I don't know anybody anything. totally privileged. I don't know. I had everything. And the other is to say, I had nothing in life as a kid. I don't know anybody anything. That's the sinful version of each of those experiences. To say, I have received or have been deprived, and therefore I am exempt. And the Torah's claim with walking in God's ways on the one hand and loving the stranger on the other is to say precisely that. I have received and I have been deprived. And the conclusion I reach from both, from each and from both together, is the project of the cultivation of compassion, is the project of manifesting chesed in the world. So amazingly, I appeal to my experiences of deep human richness and deep deprivation and aspire to the same conclusion, that is, to turn it into love, to turn it into love manifested as kindness. Now, I want to conclude by just directing your attention for a second to this last passage from the Sifra in Parshat Kedoshim from a halachic midrash. The midrash is trying to understand the words in Leviticus 19:2, Kedoshim to you, you should be holy. And it makes the following comment. Abba Shaul Omer, Abba Shaul says, Pamalya lemelech, uma alea liyot, mechaka lemelech. The retinue of the king, what is incumbent upon them? To imitate him. Those who serve the king imitate the king. But here's a great opportunity that is walking in God's ways. But in another manuscript, the following thing appears. Abba Shaul Omer, Pamalya lemelech, umahalea lihiyot, mechaka lemelech. The retinue of the king, what is incumbent upon them? To wait for him. Mechaka, mechaka. Right? With a kuf, it means to imitate. With a kaf, it means to wait. Now, what I want to suggest as a way of closing this particular talk and this whole series, and in some ways, the life of this yeshiva at the end of its first full year together, is that human beings are always most dangerous when they think they can redeem the world by themselves. And so there is a crucial component which is all about waiting. And yet, waiting doesn't mean quietism. What the Torah believes in is waiting by doing. Or, to use this language, waiting by imitating. We wait for God's presence. Matai timloch b'tzion. We wait for God's presence by imitating God's ways. Mechakim al yedei shemechakim. We wait by walking in God's ways. Thank you. Shocking. Yes, go for it. First question, I think, is that 3 weeks in a row?
Yeah. Well, I waited.
But did you imitate?
Rather than say, I would never be so, so callous as to say Judaism is about justice and Christianity is about love. But I might say Christianity is about mercy, and Judaism surely is not. Might be about justice. I tend to think it is. I don't know. I'm not well versed enough to defend that. But I find very little. I can't find any mercy in the thing. Whereas Christianity is all about it.
This is the moment in an educator's life when he considers whether he should just retire.
Because loving kindness is not necessarily mercy.
So. The claim, okay, so here's what I don't want to do. I don't want to start doing a kind of analytic philosophy of the emotions where we try to parse mercy, compassion, love, kindness. I think, first of all, it's...
Well, can I clarify what I mean? There are many occasions where justice and mercy are in conflict. And it seems to me Judaism tends to fall down on one side and Christianity on the other.
So I will say this in response to you. I think it's very interesting that when the rabbis have an opportunity to talk about what they understand as the highest level of imitating God, I can find no source that talks about tzedek. Not one. They talk about that is about justice. That is, they talk about the highest level of imitating God is, okay, we can render this however we want, chesed, a concrete set of actions, right? It is not the doing of justice. Now, that doesn't mean that the doing of justice is not really important, but it's very clear that they're making, right, an interpretive choice there. Right? On the one hand, they're not saying, look, they could have said this. Just as God throws conniptions and gets upset in the Hebrew Bible, so should you. Right? They don't say that. They actually choose to emphasize, and that in itself is an interesting discussion about how and why and by what authority do they determine which aspects of God are the ones that are deserving of imitation. But interestingly, they don't say. Later sources do talk about this, but Chazal and the Talmud, as far as I'm aware, do not talk about the doing of justice as the imitation of God. I think that's actually very significant. Now, I actually don't agree with you at all about the notion that when Jewish theology or philosophy has a choice between justice and mercy, it tends to come down on the side of mercy. When you think that it tends to come out on the side of justice, when you think about the liturgy of the days of awe, they are actually all about, where does God end up? In a place of mercy and forgiveness. And by the way, the most self-subverting piece of liturgy, pay attention to it this year when you get to it, the poem that each half line ends with, Biyom Din, and the second half ends with Badin. Have you actually read the words? Right? Lemochel avonot biyom din. Lechomel amusav bad. God who is compassionate to the ones who need him in judgment. Well, that's interesting. That's a rather perverse notion of judgment. Right? In other words, the liturgy of judgment subverts itself with a prioritization of mercy. That said, there is always a dialectic. Right? Judaism thinks that mercy without justice is dangerous, problematic, just as compassion without wisdom is a form of infantilization, right? All that's fair. But to say that the Jewish tradition prioritizes judgment or justice over mercy, I think, is to read with lenses that are skewed by our own failing and by the failing of a Christian stereotype that Christians have largely, that I've largely let go of, or at least the Christians I hang out with have largely let go of. And it's time for us to follow suit. Yeah, Eugene and then Ben.
If I could just quote on this point, Professor Michael Wishigrad, who Rabbi Held has reviewed and knows, Professor Wishigrad said, he's yet to meet a religious Jew who goes to shul on Yom Kippur and says, God, give me just what I deserve. I'm not interested in mercy.
Right, and by the way, I've also yet to meet a Jewish God who says, when you interact with another human being, make sure that your relationship all comes down to justice. Right? What is a preoccupation with forgiveness if not about, on a certain level, delaying or deferring the project of justice? Ben.
How does any of this necessitate believing God per se? Wouldn't that just be a just life to understand that I will live and have an obligation to other people, and that like, and it means what our deed means to end up being just, but if they form this life plan, why do I need to believe in God per se?
So it's interesting in this series, every time I talk about anything, right, people understandably say, you know, Ben's formulation is very interesting. Why does this necessitate belief in God? This presentation is not at all about how chesed necessitates belief in God. It's about how belief in God necessitates chesed. And I don't want there to be any confusion about that. Right? This is not an argument that being compassionate requires God. It's an argument that having God requires compassion. Now, that said, I think that the aspiration of these texts, and to be honest, I certainly cannot speak from experience here, I think that what these texts believe is that a compassion that grows out of relationship with God has a texture and a richness to it that is unique to the relationship with God. I think that's what Maimonides is partially gesturing towards at the end of The Guide of the Perplexed. Now, whether or not you want to accept that as true, I don't know. And if you want to test that empirically, I don't know how you'd go about doing it. Ultimately, to me, I internalize that as an aspiration rather than as an empirical claim. Right? My aspiration is that through living in connection to God, I will discover in myself a capacity for compassion that I otherwise might not have. One thing I think is actually very, very interesting in this regard, I'll just sort of throw this in, the Jewish ethicist Lewis Newman has argued a very interesting, I don't know if he's right, but it's very interesting. He's asked at one point, is there any interpersonal obligation that derives from theology that you couldn't derive in secular terms? That is to say, it is explicitly and purely theological. And his argument is, there is only one, and it is the obligation to forgive another person who has hurt me. That no secular moral system can generate an obligation on my part to do that. It's only a divine command. Now, I don't know if that's right. I think it's really interesting. I will also say, right, I mean, and this is a roundabout response to your point. How does the history of religion do on this question? Mixed. Right? So here's, I was once invited to speak with this philosophy professor. The question that we were asked, which I apologize but found incredibly stupid, was, does religion cause violence? Right? So my presentation was essentially two sentences long. The answer is, of course it does. But make sure you ask another question. Does religion cause love, kindness, and unspeakable generosity? Yes. So now let's talk about what kind of religion we want to have. Right? Let's talk about what it means to be an inheritor of a tradition and read it in light of its deepest claims. Right? Read a tradition in light of its deepest claims. Right? Read the tradition with the eyes of what are the ways in which this tradition cultivates chesed and compassion, and what are the ways that it doesn't? And by the way, I would argue that that is a rabbinic move, right? As I think I might have said in one of the earlier lectures, right? When Rabbi Akiva and Ben Azai say that the human being created in the image of God and the mandate to love my neighbor as myself is the great principle of Torah, what are they saying? Everything else needs to be understood in light of that. So that's the project. And to be honest, my response, you know, someone who says, look, I can be moral without God, my answer is good, we need you. I mean, it's actually on some level that simple. Especially since the fact that someone believes in God is tragically, unconscionably, and obscenely no guarantee of their morality. And sometimes, even as a goad to the opposite. That's the reality we inhabit. That's what happens when God gives religion over to people. Yeah, please. Barry.
I saw your presentation of the important point, I think, that the path is not the destination. So the path is still not the destination of Chesed. That's interesting in those who overstate the case. For example, you use the example of the Tsuba not being the end of the marriage. Obviously, the person, you know, the whole idea of marriage is doing the Tsuba, then the marriage is going to be on the rock pretty soon. But certainly, if one keeps saying Shabbat, not then inspired to an act of chesed, that may be a shortcoming, but that itself, and there is a rabbinic source on this too, itself can be a legitimate end for what that does.
So Barry, that's why I caveated it by saying, right, mitzvot are not merely ends or cannot merely be seen as their own goal. By the way, the Rambam, I think, would disagree with you. I would not disagree with you, but I think the Rambam would disagree with you. Meaning, I think the Rambam is really preoccupied with if it doesn't lead to moral virtue or it doesn't lead to a connection with God. By the way, the former is a prerequisite for the latter, according to Maimonides. Then it may be valuable, but it is, he would more ferociously want to emphasize that it is deeply deficient. Yes, I can show you places where many people disagree with the Rabbi, including Rashi, right? I can show you that, where Rashi seems to take the mitzvah of loving God to equal doing mitzvot. And The Rambam would be fundamentally appalled by that formulation because it has it backwards. The equation of those two things is unstomachable to the Rambam. Now, by the way, I think the Rambam in a way does overstate his case, meaning I'm not opposed to, you know, I'm not opposed to not spending every moment of your life thinking about, is this ritual moment, you know, cultivating a particular kind of holy compassion itself. But I am opposed to a life that gets lost in only moments where I don't think about that. And that is the danger, as Maimonides well knew, and actually as Ramban, since you quote him, knew very well, right? The danger of being preoccupied only with mitzvot is that you lose the project of what kind of human being am I? Naval birshut haTorah, right? I do all the laws, but I'm basically a schmuck, right? That's what Nachmanides talks about. So yes and no. I don't think we actually disagree about this, but yeah, please.
We talked about how sort of theological statements are supposed to instantiate themselves in these two paths. One is the concrete one, teriyag mitzvot, or what have you. The other is the asymptotic aspiration. What about when statements about the asymptotic aspiration are talked about in instantiated concrete terms, like when we say that, you know what V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha teaches us? That you shouldn't have sex during the day.
Okay, so it's funny, I thought you were going to end the question in a slightly different way. I can honestly say that was an unpredictable question. I'm going to start with a different question and then try to come to yours, right? Which is, those same things that we listed as walking in God's ways are often listed as concrete mitzvot among the tariag mitzvot also, right? And therefore, we have this interesting paradox where I think walking in God's ways has to be understood. And this is something I'm still working out, so, you know, don't hold me to this. But walking in God's ways has to be understood as transcending the doing of things as individual actions that are commanded and actually doing them from a place of love and the desire to love God by imitating God. In other words, the claim of the tradition, I think, is that visiting the sick because it's the right thing to do or even because it's a mitzvah is different than visiting the sick because of love that pours forth for me. That there's a different texture and reality to that experience, and maybe even the action itself and its impact are different. Right? It's a different self who is engaged in each of those acts and moments. Now, sometimes, you know, can I legitimate every sort of aspirational claim I make about what Torah envisions? Can I integrate that with every sort of detail of rabbinic law? No, I probably can't. And that may be as it should be, since we're trying to create a culture and a community and a set of practices and not just, you know, a set of infinite aspirations. But, yeah, there are moments where there are tensions. Look, you know, same thing applies when you talk about a values-based halakha and then you find a piece of Talmud that circumvents the value by some piece of obscure technicality. What are the rabbis really doing there? I'm not really sure, to be honest. Ask me again in 15 years. And second question, how should we relate to those passages? I'm not really sure about that either. But I don't think that any amount of sort of pointing to the ways in which these sort of perfect aspirations are interpreted imperfectly changes their status as the center of the tradition, as the tradition itself claims. In other words, I'm not making any claim here about what I think should be the heart of Judaism. I'm actually reading, I mean, I'm also doing that, but I'm doing that by reading the way I think the canonical sources themselves prioritize. Now, you should always take a statement like that with some degree of, right, some grain of salt, right? You know, it's not me talking. It is me talking, but I'm also actually reading some pretty basic fundamental canonical sources that I think make the claim about what they want to be about. As for the sex during the day, you should ask Ethan. Yeah. Yes, Judith.
I'm struck that you separate these two states, two
Yeah.
It's not a seven ishmach. It is in the doing the thing that is commanded that we come to understand the grace of the commandments and the grace of the doing.
So, fair enough. And actually, what I wanted to say when you started the question is that I was sort of, that dichotomy is intended more as a heuristic device than as a kind of concrete reality in the world. I think most likely, in most of our lives, what we experience is those things weave into each other and are often, by the way, never ask me at the end of a day at the senior citizens home, well, which was it today? Well, first of all, there were moments when I was doing it because, you know, I'm obligated. There were moments when I was doing it because, you know what, I was loving this person. And there were moments when I was doing it because, you know what, I signed up to do this as part of my job, right? It was all of those things. Now, I think you're right, right? There is a degree. I mean, so I'm always stuck with the same problem of when you give three talks, right, you can't say everything you've ever wanted to say about Judaism, right? So one of the things that I, you know, would say in a more expanded series about faith is precisely about the category of simcha shel mitzvah, right, the category of the delight in commandedness, which, by the way, I think that category in rabbinics is the single most powerful refutation of everything Paul and Luther said about the role of law in Judaism, right? The notion of taking delight in obligation, that it's something that in the language of the Tanakh, I literally want to dance over rather than feel, you know, shattered, oppressed, and rendered paralyzed by. So that's for sure true. And yet, I think there is a way in which for many Jewish sources, certainly for, just as a concrete example that stands out to me right now, someone like the Maharal, the great 16th century Jewish thinker, there's a way in which when it comes to chesed, just doing it because I'm obligated, I haven't yet arrived in what I'm supposed to be doing. The same way, by the way, that even when it comes to Yeshayahu Leibowitz's profound misreading of Maimonides notwithstanding, right? Ultimately, I do mitzvot because I love God. That's the aspiration. That's how Hilchot Teshuvah ends. So, okay, that's not a perfect answer, but it's the beginning of an answer. Okay, one last comment or question or thought? Yeah, Bree. Can we go back to talking about sex during the day? the question that you ask is, I think, ultimately the most powerful and compelling challenge to any faith that imagines that God has a will in any way, however we understand those words. And it's a version of what I talked about around the Tzelem Elohim issue, which is, right, at a certain point, when the degradation becomes so vast and so powerful, it has the potential to render everything you say cheap, Pollyanna, offensive, worse yet, legitimating other people's pain, which is something we should always be extremely cautious about. And I take that, you know, very seriously. One of the things, I mean, if you want to talk about another level of holding complexity, I would say, you know, here just speaking very personally, there are moments in which I am as certain as I can be without running afoul of what I said last week, that there is a God who cares. And then there are moments when I think, right, you must be nuts, right? I mean, how can you possibly be awake to the world and make that claim? And the truth is, you know, as I said last time, that's where the gesture of faith becomes either something that compels you or something that you find impossible. And the truth is, for someone who says, I can't believe because of the enormity of the way people are destroyed by their suffering, I bow my head to that. Right, I have no desire. It reminds me of something my teacher Yitz Greenberg once said to me, right? The difference between an atheist and a theist is not how much, but how often, which I think is actually really powerful and interesting. So how to respond religiously to people who are so broken by their suffering that they feel they can't, and finish that sentence however you want, right? So the first is, if you really need to do theodicy and try to understand or justify God, okay, fine, do it. But don't do theodicy if you're not also going to spend a piece of your life trying to heal that pain. Because you have no right to speak, right? You have to earn the right to talk about why a God would allow other people to suffer. The other thing I would just say about this is, I think it is amazing the number of people I have known who have been totally convinced that they are so destroyed by their suffering that they just can't, and then to some tiny extent, and sometimes not so tiny extent, they do. And that resilience of the human body, the human spirit, is something enormously sacred. Is it a revelation of God? Once again, it depends where you're standing and where what you start with. But the fact that there are so many people so deeply broken by suffering, the deepest answer to that I think Judaism can offer is, so what are you doing for them? That is not a metaphysical answer. It is a human, halachic response that ultimately says, you know, there is a point at which words mean a lot less than generosity. So that's not really an answer. I'm not sure there is an answer in this world. And if I ever have the occasion, I have some questions about how this world operates. But in the meantime, right, the only option, as far as I understand it, is to serve God by loving, even if part of your love for God is also tinged eternally by disappointment in God. That's the only thing I can possibly say in response to that. Thank you all very much.